U.S. businesses thrive on Alibaba's online marketplace, where sales by American companies to Chinese consumers added $53 billion to the U.S. economy in 2022. Discover more at AlibabaPowersBusinesses.com.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
President Biden rolls out the first veto of his presidency, and surprise, surprise, it's a great big favor to the climate industry and Democratic special interest groups. Also, the White House and Democrats engage in a preemptive strike against House Republicans in the upcoming budget wars. Does the GOP have a plan? And if so, where is it? Welcome to Potomac Watch. I'm Kim Strassel. I am joined today by my fabulous colleagues, Kate Batchelder Odell and Manet Ukwe-Barua. President Biden on Monday vetoed a bipartisan congressional resolution. It was his very first veto. And the history here, the Biden Labor Department in late 2022 issued a final rule designed to protect retirement funds that use ESG or environmental, social, and governance factors as part of their investment decisions. This was a big break from traditional fiduciary standards, which require retirement fund managers to maximize profits. And so this inspired a big backlash, and Congress recently used its authority under the Congressional Review Act to overturn that Labor Department rule, a vote in which Democrats in both the House and the Senate joined Republicans to kill it. Only then Biden vetoed that resolution, meaning his new Labor Department standard remains. Let's listen to Biden explain that veto.
I just signed this veto because the legislation passed by the Congress would put at risk the retirement savings of individuals across the country. They couldn't take into consideration investments that wouldn't be impacted by climate, impacted by overpaying executives, and that's why I decided to veto it. It makes sense to veto it.
So, Kate, that's not exactly how I put what's going on here, but the president is entitled to his spin. ESG investing has obviously been growing in controversy. Why don't just to lay the groundwork? What is it? Who's been pushing it? Why is it controversial?
Yeah, Kim, I mean, ESG stands for environmental, social, or governance. And the point here is basically to allow investment managers to let political factors influence their investment decisions. So what we're talking about, and this is a very large growing industry and may represent, you know, even a third of private assets under management, it really allows investors to consider something, things like companies' climate change portfolio or the diversity makeup of their board in investment decisions. Now, the reason why I think it's becoming controversial and is really leading to a pretty broad backlash that includes states, state governors, is because people understand that this is taking the supposed sacrosanct fiduciary duty to maximize returns on their retirement accounts and allowing other factors to influence those investment decisions. Now, Kim, I just point out that if some of these factors that are so important, like social investing here, if they produce better returns, there wouldn't be an issue with making those investments. The problem here is what we're saying is basically, we are going to prioritize something over maximizing your return. And as somebody who has a 401k, that is a really big problem for Americans who are trying to maximize their savings in their retirement accounts.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. Look, there's a couple of reasons this is controversial. One, this is in part, by the way, too, it's a big payoff using government power to kind of direct more capital into a lot of the left's priorities on climate change and social justice causes. But Manet, as Kate was saying, the other reason this is controversial is, you know, for the sake of this rule, at least, is a question here is performance. And to put it really simply, a lot of people have money automatically deducted from their paychecks to save for their future. Some people might be very active about managing their 401ks, but for a lot of people here, probably the vast majority, they put it in some blended fund. If you're a public employee, maybe it's going into some big pension fund. And you just want to know that the people who are running it are doing everything they can to maximize your returns for your retirement. And you don't want to think that they're using your money to kind of fund these causes that might sound nice, but might undermine corporate returns. And Manet, correct me if I'm wrong here, but there is some real evidence out there that, in fact, ESG funds do underperform compared to their benchmarks, but also especially compared to some of those stocks that they actually shun, for instance, oil and gas companies.
Exactly. The past year has been a real reckoning for ESG funds in terms of their performance relative relative to the broader market. And so to back up a little bit, I think it's interesting to point out that ESG funds during the first 4 to 5 years that they became very popular actually did perform on par with the market, or in some cases even a little bit better. Part of that is because they're heavily invested in tech firms, because these tech firms are not producing emissions themselves, nor are they using suppliers who are producing emissions, what's called scope 3 emissions that a company would include in its filings. And so they saw a pretty big run up, and a lot of these pension fund managers and other investors were able to say, we're doing well by doing good. They could point to the returns of these funds and show, we're not sacrificing returns to investors because of our priorities of these environmentally sound companies. But in 2022, that really all began to reverse, because as the market as a whole started to slide about 20% for the S&P 500, we also saw over-representation of some of these ESG-friendly companies, particularly in tech, sliding even more. And so out of the top 10 biggest ESG funds, 8 of them underperformed the market last year. And so it definitely should be an open question to anyone with their money in a pension fund right now. Is my money being invested in a way that is likely to produce the best possible returns? Or is the manager of my fund including other priorities along with maximizing returns? And just to finish that off, the other exception or the other reason why ESG slid relative to the market, as you pointed out, Kim, was that oil and gas actually was the best of the major sectors in 2020. It actually grew in value significantly. And so if you happen to have your retirement shuttled to an ESG fund, you are missing out on the gains in the stocks in that sector for entirely political reasons.
Yeah, and we are also seeing the benefits have been flowing to some of those managers who did stay in oil and gas stocks and who ended up doing very well by their portfolios by comparison to everyone else. So Kate, you know, this question of a labor rule governing fiduciaries is actually, it's not necessarily new, even though the Biden rule only came out late last year. Retirement and pension fund managers are fiduciaries, and that means they are legally required to make investment decisions with one real purpose, which is maximizing retirees' financial interests. And that's actually built into federal law, something called the Employee Retirement Income Security Act. And the question for a while, and I think in fairness, this has been a concern for a lot of retirement plan managers, was could you even use ESG, or would you potentially be subject to lawsuits? And that's why the Trump administration was actually the first, and they put forward regulations that allowed ESG factors to be used as tiebreakers when a fund manager was choosing between two equal investments. Now, I don't know if I even agree with that idea, but you could say that at least the Trump regulations were applying some safeguards against the expansion of ESG criteria. But just delving a little bit more into this labor rule that the president is protecting now, Kate, it seems to be exactly the opposite. It's very much a rule encouraging people to use these factors to expand, and maybe push managers to delve more deeply into ESG. Is that, I think, correct reading?
Yeah, it is, Kim. I mean, keep in mind that the Biden rule will protect fiduciaries from lawsuits when they're considering these factors that may be, quote, relevant to a company's performance. So that basically shields them from any liability there and allows them to invest retirement savings however they want. So it's not just, you know, the more narrow safeguards that Trump was trying to carve out there. And I agree with you. I'm not sure. I think that allowing it to be used as a tiebreaker factor is open to interpretation. But I do think this rule that Biden is talking about is much, much broader, and not only allows some narrow use of ESG, but encourages everyone to use it and makes it harder for those who think that their money has been misinvested to have any sort of recourse. So that's a much broader rule. And also, the Biden rule would basically try to empower the proxy advisory firms in these disputes as well. So that it is basically, to your earlier point, kind of an attempt to funnel more capital into their industries of choice through these very broad regulations.
Yeah, I think the lawsuit point is really key, because if you could be protected from litigation like this, then you're very much leaving these pension fund managers open to all of the public pressure that we have seen out there, which has been very effective at getting companies to believe that they must adopt these initiatives and pension fund managers to take them into consideration entirely because of the risk of getting on the wrong side of some of these activist groups that then go after you if you don't. So, Monet, that brings up the point that it seems now that if you're going to make a change, especially with this Biden rule in place, that you're going to instead have to have some other officials, maybe at the state level, begin to push back on this. And that's exactly what we're seeing. I think a little bit more than a week ago, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis put out a joint statement proposed by Florida, but it was a coalition of 18 states. And they committed themselves to leading state level efforts to protect their individuals from the ESG movement. DeSantis, for instance, and state officials changed the policies on Florida's more than $220 billion in pension funds to say that investment decisions should be guided only by potential returns. We're seeing this across some other states. How big of a backlash is this? Are we seeing money now coming out of these ESG funds?
Well, it has begun a broad movement among Republican governors. I believe even before DeSantis's action, the Texas controller decided to list several funds that would be banned for pension funds in that state to make investments because of their commitment to ESG. And I believe there are several other governors who are either considering pulling out or who have already put controls on what types of brands, what types of labels for the funds that their retirement accounts for state employees can be shoveled towards, and making sure that there aren't political considerations along with the traditional fiduciary ones. And part of that, again, is political. They don't want to be funding these investment funds that are intentionally being channeled to hurt some priorities like energy that a lot of these states depend on, and that they don't believe that there is a strong relationship between some of the environmental factors and the actual financial performance of these funds. But another reason is the fees. A lot of these funds tend to charge significantly higher fees than comparable ones from other large investment firms. And so these states that are investing over a very long term often are having to raise taxes or make other difficult decisions in order to keep their pension funds funded, pay really careful attention to those fees. And because they invest so much with these firms, they have quite a lot of leverage and quite a lot of options in terms of where they go. And so it makes sense, even on an upfront level, putting aside the potential returns down the road, to go to funds that are not going to charge fees unless those fees can be justified by an investment strategy which is actually likely to produce a better return down the road.
That's a great point, Monet, and brings to mind the fact that somehow the whole point about these high fees didn't make it into Biden's State of the Union address about the other junk fees he was concerned about. We're going to take a break. When we come back, the White House and House Democrats warn that the sky will fall if Republicans are successful in cutting back some federal spending. What's behind the attacks, and what's the GOP doing about it? When we come back.
U.S. businesses thrive on Alibaba's online marketplace, where sales by American companies to Chinese consumers added $53 billion to the U.S. economy in 2022. Discover more at AlibabaPowersBusinesses.com.
Don't forget, you can reach the latest episode of Potomac Watch anytime. Just ask your smart speaker, play the Opinion Potomac Watch podcast.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Welcome back. I'm Kim Strassel. I'm here with Monet Ukwebarua and Kate Batchelder Odell. So on Monday, we saw a joint attack. House Appropriations Chair Rosa DeLauro posted online letters that she'd received from nearly all the Biden cabinet heads and agency heads. And she had written to them back in January during the fight over whether Kevin McCarthy would become speaker. And according to reports at that time, one of the things McCarthy agreed to in order to secure votes was to agree to a budget that would return non-defense discretionary spending to fiscal 2022 levels. That would necessitate cutting about $130 million from non-defense discretionary spending from the most recent levels that we got in the omnibus of late last year. So she asked these heads to detail what would happen, just how bad would it be if, heaven forfend, we had to go back to spending what we spent just one fiscal year ago. The White House also jumped in, spending this week spelling out the coming doom. Kate, can you tell us about some of the horrors, at least according to Democrats, that will befall the nation if we have to go back to fiscal 2022 levels?
Yes, we're back to the budget future, where we have this brinksmanship about everything bad that's going to happen if we go with someone else's budget. And so some of the things that the Democrats are picking here, I have to admit, are quite hilarious. One of DeLauro's first complaints is that the cuts would make our border less safe. I'm not sure how we'd be able to tell at this point, but she also lists it would take money out of the transportation industry, that it would harm education. I mean, there's a whole laundry list of subjects. But Kim, I think we need to focus on what's really going on here. The first is that domestic agencies have been getting double-digit percentage plus ups for years. And Democrats also have been using COVID emergency bills to dump more money into domestic agencies. The run-up in domestic spending over the past few years has been really significant. So the idea of going back to just 2022 levels is really not as big of a cut as they would like everybody to think. The second thing here, Kim, and this is kind of a classic in Washington, is to just pick the most painful things on the planet to cut so that you try to, you know, put the damage on your political opponents. In this case, you know, the Democrats are talking about, oh, we're going to shut down 125 air traffic control towers and strand people and make them even more angry at the airport. And we've seen in shutdowns past, you know, you shut down the national parks and cancel the family trip to Yellowstone and just try to make it as damaging as possible. It's really a skullduggery tactic here. So these are some of the things that they are trying to fan out. I think the cuts are really just much more modest than understood. And there is also would be a way to manage them without that kind of pain.
Yes. Speaking of skullduggery, one of the little tricks that they used in these letters was to make the assumption that, in fact, the cuts would have to be much greater than 8% or $130 billion because Republicans intend to throw money at the defense budget. And in order to do that, they'd have to cut domestic non-defense discretionary budgets even more to pay for it. Of course, this isn't in any way a for sure thing. Some of us are actually concerned Republicans won't put more money into the defense budget. But some of these letters relied on a fictional assumption that, you know, these agencies would be seeing these sweeping, striking budget cuts in order to make that transfer. Monet, the proximate cause of this attack is that earlier this month, the House Freedom Caucus, which is about 40 members of the Republican Party in the House, more on conservative fiscal side, they laid out their proposed budget, which did call for some pretty big changes in terms of clawing back money and cutting outlays. Let's listen to House Freedom Caucus Chair Scott Perry talk about that budget.
To shrink Washington, we save money now by ending President Biden's $400 billion student loan bailout. We rescind all unobligated COVID-19 funds. We recoup the $80 billion in IRS expansion funds. And we recoup billions of dollars of wasteful climate change spending in the so-called Inflation Reduction Act. And by finding every single dollar spent by Democrats that can be reclaimed for the American taxpayer. Doing this will lower dollar for dollar the amount needed for any increase in the debt ceiling. It's actually what families across America who find themselves overextended must do.
So as noted, the House Freedom Caucus, it's a more conservative part of the caucus. So yes, this is a more sweeping proposal they laid out. But it's not the official Republican position. Republicans haven't put out their position. So, Monet, what's the White House up to? Why is it going after this one particular bill that isn't necessarily the expression of the Republican Party? What's it teeing up for? How does this play into the debt ceiling debate that's coming?
Well, I think Joe Biden and Democrats here are playing a classic strategy of exaggerate the position of your opponent in order to make your own extreme position look a little bit more moderate in comparison. And so I think that if Americans took a close, hard look at the omnibus bill that Congress passed and President Biden signed last December and looked at the roughly 10% increase in domestic non-defense discretionary spending, they would be appalled to see not only some of the waste in certain programs, but the overall level of increase. And the fact that, as Kate was saying, that's now being treated as a baseline that cannot be lowered under any circumstances shows how radical their own position is. And so they know that this is going to be a drawn-out fight, having to come to an agreement in order to get the debt ceiling increased. It's possible that some of their members are going to be open to making cuts, but they want to minimize the amount of actual painful reductions that they might have to approve in order to get a deal. And so it benefits them to exaggerate the position that Republicans have taken. As far as the Freedom Caucus proposal, I think that Scott Perry and the rest of his group among the House Republicans know that these budget fights are a big opportunity to show off your priorities. They know as well as anyone that Democratic Senate and Democratic President are not going to enact some of these proposals, but they want Americans to know that they would like to claw back that $80 billion for the IRS, that they would like to prevent the student loan forgiveness proposal from becoming law. And so the question is, once Kevin McCarthy actually begins having the hard conversations with President Biden and with Chuck Schumer about what agreement they're going to strike to get the debt ceiling increased, are these House Republicans going to still stick to their ideal proposal that they released, or are they going to be willing to allow a little bit more space to hopefully get a deal that will include significant cuts, but also has a chance of being approved by Democrats too?
That is the question. When is this going to happen, and is it going to happen? Why do Republicans not have a position yet? You know, Kate, I remember when we were doing the speaker's fight, we got it over with, and it meant that Republicans said they were supposed to turn quickly to this debt ceiling fight because, you know, we're going to hit the debt ceiling sometime this summer. And at least in theory, the GOP plan is to say, if you want our votes to raise it, you, the White House, are going to have to agree to some of our spending reduction plans. But to go in there and have that leverage, first, you have to have a plan. And yet here we are. The statutory deadline for Congress passing a budget resolution is April 15th. McCarthy has already said he's going to blow by that. He's got a little bit of an excuse in that the president was months late submitting his own budget, which is supposed to come first. But it strikes me, Kate, that the real reason that there isn't a plan yet is because he still has a lot of problems. Fights over whether to touch entitlements, how deeply to cut, what to do about defense. And yet, Kate, correct me if I'm wrong, this attack by the White House seems to be a very vivid reminder that until and unless the GOP gets behind something, it's not going to have any leverage in this debt ceiling fight. Last word.
No kidding, Kim. I mean, with a majority as thin as the Republican one, they have to pick their fights and show some discipline. I think there could be a couple good ones for them, including rescinding the COVID money that hasn't been spent, or the IRS money that is used to go after middle income earners and audits. There could be places for that where they could notch a couple wins and focus around a couple ideas where they could control spending. Instead, what we're seeing is sort of this 11th hour, a huge effort, for instance, oh, we're going to do huge reforms in the Defense Department. Now, I'd be all for military healthcare reform or selling the U.S. military golf courses, but those are multi-year efforts that take consensus building and a coalition to get through and get done. And so they really need to make their priorities clear and develop a budget resolution, or they're just going to keep taking fire from these positions that they don't actually hold, like the Freedom Caucus budget.
Yes, notable that there hasn't been a lot of GOP response this week other than from the Freedom Caucus because, again, they don't yet have a plan. Thank you, Manet. Thank you, Kate. And thank you to our listeners. We want to remind you that we are here every day of the week. We'll be back tomorrow. You can email us at pwpodcast@wsj.com. If you like the show, please hit the subscribe button.
U.S. businesses thrive on Alibaba's online marketplace, where sales by American companies to Chinese consumers added $53 billion to the U.S. economy in 2022. Discover more at alibabapowersbusinesses.com.